This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Last year at this time, the Hubble Space Telescope was in serious need of a little bit of TLC. It had a couple of dead cameras, a broken spectrograph, aging batteries, a flaky gyroscope, and on top of all that, a major piece of hardware blew out, and a scheduled repair mission was put off for months, leaving us to wonder if Hubble might be left there twisting in the solar wind, so to speak. But the final repair mission went off without a hitch last May, updating the old parts, outfitting Hubble with a sharp new camera, the Wide Field Camera 3. And astronomers have already discovered amazing star stuff with that new camera, detecting what could be the most distant galaxies known to science, formed not too long after the birth of the universe. That's just one of the bits of news coming out of the American Astronomical Society meeting in Washington, D.C. And my guest has been hanging out there this week. Ron Cowan is the astronomy writer for Science News in Washington. He joins us from our studios at NPR. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot, Ari. Hi.
And if you want to know more about Ron's work, you can read it at sciencenews.org. Sounds like interesting stuff coming out of there. What is this old galaxy?
Well, there's actually it's three of the oldest galaxies in the universe, they think. The finding is tentative, but these are galaxies that they believe lie 13.2 billion years light years from Earth, and we're seeing them very close to what's called cosmic dawn, the era when the first galaxies and stars turned on, just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. That few hundred million years may sound like a long time, but that's actually pretty darn close to the birth of the universe. Mm-hmm. And it's just very, very exciting they can do this with the Hubble.
Wow. There were another set of discoveries, this time exoplanets from Kepler. Tell us what Kepler was and what this discovery.
Yes. So the Kepler telescope, it was launched into space last March, and its main mission is to look for planets beyond the solar system that are in the so-called habitable zone that could support life, and in fact, Earth-like planets. But what's exciting here is that just after its first 6 weeks of data, Kepler has already found five alien planets, extrasolar planets. None of them yet are Earth-like. One is a Neptune body, similar mass to Neptune. The other four, similar mass to Jupiter. They're very close to their parent stars. They're hot enough that the temperature would be enough to melt lava on their surface. Yeah. They're not habitable, but it's very exciting that in just 6 weeks, Kepler did this, it bodes well for finding Earth-like planets during the next 3.5 years of its mission.
And how does it work? How does this probe work?
Right. Well, what it does is it looks for planets that pass across the face of their parent star. And each time a planet does that, it creates a little mini eclipse. It eclipses like 1% or less of the starlight, and Kepler is that sensitive that it can look for this tiny little wink out of light. And of course, it happens periodically each time the planet passes in front of its parent star. And so these are called transits. Kepler finds those. Then they contact someone on the ground with a telescope that can look for the tug back and forth, the tiny tug that the planet exerts on its parent star, and then you find the mass that way. So you can find the size of the size of the planet from Kepler, the mass from ground-based telescopes.
Interesting. Talking with Ron Cowan of Science News, a writer there. You can read more about his stuff at sciencenews.org. Let's talk about you mentioned the earliest galaxies we've ever seen, but there mm-hmm. was also something at the meeting about the earliest supernovas or supernovae.
Yes, or supernovae, right. Well, there was now the most distant supernova we think exists. These are exploding stars. They're not as bright as so you can't see them quite as far back in time. But there's another type of explosion called a gamma ray burst, and mm-hmm. gamma ray bursts are this incredible outpouring of gamma ray light that we think signifies the birth of a black hole. You can see those very, very far away. And the light from this gamma ray burst pierced its home galaxy, and the dust on its way that it pierced seems to be dust from a supernova. So we've deduced some of the earliest stardust, or they call it smoke, from a supernova that we've ever seen in the universe before. It's indirect, but they believe that they found it.
Is that where they think that these gamma ray bursts all come from?
Well, a gamma ray burst, in fact, comes from a particular type of supernova, but These supernovae would be just a whole string of supernovae in the galaxy that would be separate from the one the gamma ray burst was given birth to. Mm-hmm.
The new NASA administrator, Charles Bolden, spoke at the conference. Give us some take-home points.
Right. Well, he was certainly very folksy, and one of the things he said was that back in 1980, when he was training as an astronaut, he said to the audience that if someone had told him then that would not have returned to the moon with a manned mission yet, that he would have told those people they would have been smoking dope. So that got a big laugh from everybody.
That was the old Arthur C. He stole Arthur C. Clarke's line, you know.
Arthur
C. Clarke said many years ago. Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke said many years ago, and I think maybe let's say the 25th anniversary of the moonwalk. He said, "What's the most exciting, amazing thing about going to the moon?" And he said that we could go there and not go back.
Mm-hmm. But I think Bolden was giving some signals that, well, you know, we will go on to Mars, but it might be more gradual. We can't pay for big expensive missions. We're going to need international cooperation. I think he was giving hints that we may not go back to the moon and Mars quite so fast, at least in my opinion. And we'll have to wait for what Obama says, I guess, in his State of the Union address. But I think Bolden was giving hints like that. But I think the audience loved him. And he was very natural.
Yeah, he was. But was he focusing on international space missions, or did he just mention that in passing?
I think he just mentioned that in passing, but saying that, you know, for big missions in the future, we're really going to have to find other ways to pay for them, and we're going to have to go with other countries to do that.
Anything on upcoming, you know, on the Webb telescope? Any mention of that, when Hubble is gone?
Yes, in the sense of the fact that these candidate distant galaxies that they think they found from so far back in time and so distant, we are not really going to be able to examine them closely and confirm for sure that they really are as distant until the James Webb Space Telescope gets launched in 2014. Hubble found these distant galaxies, or these candidate distant galaxies, with looking at them at just one infrared wavelength. And James Webb is a much bigger telescope, and it's going to look at several infrared wavelengths at these same objects and really confirm not just that they exist, but how massive are they? Do they have a black hole at their center? All kinds of things which we really are dying to know, because this is just the earliest moments of galaxy formation in the universe. And but it's also remarkable what we've done already.
Well, sounds like a good time was had by all at this meeting.
Mm-hmm. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
All right, Ron, thanks for taking time to be with us. Ron Cowan is the astronomy writer for Science News in Washington, and you can get more on the meeting by going to their website at sciencenews.org. Next up, America's number one New Year's resolution. Maybe you made it yourself, right? What is it? It's losing weight. And with good reason, because one recent study predicts that nearly half of all Americans will be obese by 2020, 10 years from now, but certainly putting a burden on the nation's health system. You know what used to be? Smoking used to be the biggest cause of preventable death and disease. And did today, as fewer people smoke and obesity rates creep up, obesity has now surpassed smoking as the biggest burden on America's health, according to a study out this week in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And we also saw life expectancy march up into octogenarian territory in the last decade, but the obesity epidemic could be slowing down that trend. Well, what are we going to do about it? How about a war on obesity? We only had a war on smoking. It was pretty successful. But how much of that can you apply? How many of those lessons learned there actually can be applied to an obesity epidemic? Or do we need a different approach? And that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Always also Twittering. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or in Second Life. You can join folks there. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Erica Lubetkin is an associate medical professor in the Department of Community Health and Social Medicine at City College here in New York. She's also author of that study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, and she's here in our studios. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lubetkin.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Were you surprised at your own results, what you found at the study?
No, I wasn't surprised. Our results were something that people have spoken about for a long time, and you could see the trends emerging. But what we had was the trend data, which we had a big data set, and we were able to show it.
Mm-hmm. And how fast is it moving? How fast is the trend going?
Well, we're not quite sure. As of 2008, the paths crossed one another, where obesity became an equal, if not greater, contributor to the burden of disease. Mm-hmm. And by burden of disease, I mean shortening of healthy life, because we examined both the effects of the length of life and the quality of life.
When you mean shortening, it actually takes years off of people's lives statistically?
Well, we looked at something called quality-adjusted life years, where we were able to look at the quality of life, activity limitation, disability, as well as the length of life. So we were able to look at those in a single number, whereas a lot of previous studies looked at premature deaths, both morbidity, sickness, and then mortality.
Also with us is Matthew Gilman. He's professor and director of the Obesity Prevention Program in the Department of Population Medicine at Harvard. He joins us over the phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Gilman.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
What is the difference between overweight and obesity? Because we keep talking about overweight, we have obesity, and does it make a difference?
Well, we have some definitions that are typically based on something called body mass index, or BMI, which some of your listeners may have heard of. That's an index where we divide the weight in kilograms by the square of the height in meters. And it's a pretty good measure of fatness, at least for clinical and population use. Mm-hmm. In adults, obese is defined as a BMI above 30 and overweight between 25 and 30, and between 18.5 and 25 is normal. Mm-hmm. In kids, where weight gain accompanies our growth, how much we grow in height, we have to compare ourselves with other kids the same age and sex, and so we use what's called percentiles. So over the 95th percentile is considered obese, and between the 85th and the 95th is considered overweight.
All right. I'm going to have to stop you there because we have to take a break, but we will come back and talk lots more with Dr. Lubetkin and Dr. Gilman. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, if we want to talk about the obesity epidemic. Also, tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about America's obesity epidemic with my guests, Dr. Erica Lubetkin. She's at City College here in New York. Matthew Gilman and Harvard Med School. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Gilman, you know, we talk about being overweight and eating, but how much of our epidemic is due to the proliferation of junk food and, you know, fast food? Because it's a lot cheaper. And maybe there is a difference in people who can't afford to buy good food, and the junk food is cheaper.
Well, it's a really good question about what's caused the obesity epidemic. And I think most people think it's multifactorial. You know, if you go back in evolution, it sort of makes sense that when we're faced with extra food, it pays to pack it on, because in the past, we wouldn't know where our next meal was coming from. But in today's world, where it's feast all the time and very little famine for most people, it's hard to keep the extra calories off. And I think there are many things in our environment that have helped us to overeat, whether it be the food industry who make profits from selling more food, so the ubiquitousness of fast food, as you say, sugar-sweetened beverages and things like that, but also the lack of physical activity and a lot of the, you know, the energy-saving devices we have, whether it be cars or elevators or things like that, tend to keep us from getting as much physical activity as we'd like. Mm-hmm. Then recently we've, you know, been learning about some other factors, for example, watching too much television, which may have its effect through either physical activity or overeating, and things like too little sleep, which may have a direct effect on hormones that tend to have us overeat.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lubetkin, sitting here like a bobblehead doll, shaking your head up and down about all these things. You agree?
Oh, I agree entirely. I think that the big contributors are the changes in the food in terms of, you know, eating more food, bigger portions, fast food, changes in the physical activity, especially I'm an internist, so I see adults, but certainly on the pediatric level in terms of less exercise, more TV watching, static activities. Video games, exactly. And that's been correlated, as well as changes in healthcare in terms of lack of health insurance, not having a primary care provider, other aspects.
What about, when I go to a fast food restaurant, and what has helped me are the calorie things. If I'm saying, gee, maybe I'll have a vanilla shake today, and I look and see it has 600 calories in it or something, it actually changes my habits. Has that contributed or helped people to stop eating, some of the fast foods at all? Does it work, that kind of approach?
I think both of you are actually sitting in New York City, which has led the way in posting calorie counts on menus. Some other cities, counties, states are following that lead, and there's ongoing research to determine whether it's really effective in getting people to eat fewer calories. It's a very interesting approach, and it makes sense, as you say.
1-800-989-8255. Let's get some listener calls here. Victor in, this is Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Boy, did you blow that one. Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Oconomowoc, of course. I left one letter out, but an important one. Go ahead. Welcome to Science
Friday. Yeah, I just wanted to say the great fitness guru Kate Moss said nothing tastes as good as skinny feels, and that's supposed to be a joke. We all know she's a coke-addled supermodel, but she's right, like a broken clock twice a day, and I've lost 30 pounds over the last 3 months by just getting used to being just a little bit hungry, not going for seconds, cutting out the sugars. And by the way, why are we subsidizing the U.S. sugar industry? I'm going to hang up and let you
chew on that.
My comment.
Okay.
Oh, yes. You have a question.
No. So it's okay. Well, bad joke on my part. What do you say to that, Matthew?
Well, I think your guest may actually have some good advice for people who either want to lose weight or actually may not want to gain weight. And that is, small changes over a long period of time can be very helpful. Our physiology, as I was talking about before, because of evolution, tends to resist weight loss. When we gain weight, we come to a new physiologic set point or something like that. And our hormones in our body, when we lose weight after that, say, oh, geez, you might be starving. Let's keep eating. So a lot of times it's easier to keep from gaining weight than to try to lose weight.
There are various weight-losing shows on TV now where they're actually contests, where they're very obese people come on to lose 20, 30 pounds, a week. Is this a healthy way to lose weight?
Well, as a clinician and public health researcher, especially who deals with, I deal with both kids and adults, but my view is that we really ought to be talking about prevention of weight gain starting very early in life. And a lot of our research deals with what things happen during pregnancy and infancy and early childhood that lead to either more or less weight gain. And we're learning things like the amount of weight that a woman gains during pregnancy, whether she gets diabetes, even whether she smokes, can have an impact on her child's obesity. Mm-hmm. And once the kids are born, breastfeeding, the amount of sleep they get, these things are very important, I think, for having people not gain weight in the first place and not having to face the question that you're actually asking.
Yeah. Adam in San Antonio, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. I think it's great what you just brought up. I can't remember which researcher it was, but talking about early in life, there's two things I'd like to talk about regarding that. The first is, I think legal reform on what is allowed in schools, in public schools, would be great. I think Coke and Pepsi are not all that different from, say, tobacco companies, in that they try to get young people started on junk food as early as possible. And they do it in such a way that allows them to look like heroes because they enter into these contracts with public schools and, they're like, Powerade is a proud sponsor of this whatever school, and it allows them to look like they're helping. And in my opinion, they're definitely causing a lot of hurt. But secondly, I'd like to see a healthy eating ad campaign of some sort that would allow us to feel perhaps patriotic, at least good citizens for eating well. When we eat well and we take care of ourselves, mm-hmm. we're able to go to work, we're able to make money, we're able to take better care of our families, and we're just better people all around, and few people are proud to eat well.
Let me get a reaction from our guests. Erica, what do you think of a campaign like that?
Well, in terms of the former campaign with regard to the school-based setting, I think it's an excellent place in terms of these habits are formed very early, and it's a good regulated environment in terms of healthy lunches in the cafeteria, physical activity regulations, which vary from state to state, and really an emphasis on nutrition and prevention. And so I think that that's a wonderful place to start, and especially keeping the sugar, the sweet juices and sodas out of the school environment. And the second thing is, I think in terms of our quality of life, there's been a lot of studies in terms of obesity. And certainly if you look at, we measure what's called health-related quality of life, which is your physical, your emotional, your social well-being. And a lot of the literature has shown that obesity in particular leads to worse outcomes with regard to how you feel about yourself.
Thanks for calling, Adam. But you can tell this to people, but do they have the willpower? Do they have the means? Do they have the money to change their lifestyle to become thinner or to stay thin or to change their diets or their exercise habits?
This is a very good question. You know, I think there's been a lot of emphasis on what some people call personal responsibility in changing lifestyle behaviors. Mm-hmm. But we also have to recognize that we live in an environment that restricts our behaviors. And if you're living, for example, in an urban neighborhood where it's not safe to go out and get some exercise, and the only food that's available is from a fast food restaurant or a bodega or a mom-and-pop store, it's very, very hard to change your behavior. And if you're a kid, and if you're living with a single mom, and she's working two jobs, and you're a latchkey kid, it's very hard to get the physical activity or to eat right. So I think while we have to address individual behavior change, it's really important that we think about changing the obesogenic environment.
And how would you do that? Any suggestions?
Well, I think we've already heard on this program some ideas about how to do that, whether it be in the child care setting, school setting, the medical setting, the built environment. I think people are starting to do this in different ways. We heard earlier about menu labeling in restaurants.
Could you subsidize, let's say, I'm just going to think off the top of my head, let's say a lot of people get food stamps now. Could you get more food stamps if you buy healthier food, fruits, vegetables, and things, disproportionately just to getting to the stamps in general? How about that as a suggestion? So you can afford to buy healthier food.
I think that's a wonderful idea. And in terms of combating the obesity epidemic, you'll need multiple strategies. Mm-hmm. One size doesn't fit all in terms of policies. But certainly we all know that going to McDonald's, it's a lot cheaper to get a meal there than, you know, a healthy salad at a salad bar.
Right.
You know, you brought up the issue of smoking at the top of the program. And I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned about the anti-smoking campaigns. For example, it was, you know, the combination of individual behavior change, like doctors telling their patients to stop smoking or never start, but plus environmental interventions like taxing cigarettes that helped us really reduce smoking in this country. Mm-hmm. However, you also have to say that it's a little bit more complex with obesity because eating behavior is neither legal nor illegal. There's a big gray zone about what's healthy and what's not healthy. Mm-hmm. Still, some people are talking about taxing sugar-sweetened beverages.
Right.
A lot of these beverages really are empty calories, and there's no sort of redeeming social nutritive value to them. So we can probably agree on some strategies that are fairly translatable from our experience in smoking to our experience in obesity.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We have a question in from Silverwing Benoit in the Second Life says, do artificial sweeteners help people lose weight or reinforce their need for sweets? If you taste that sweetness, you say, I've got to have the real thing, I guess is the question. Any thoughts on that?
This is an area that's sort of still up for grabs. There have been some studies, both short-term and sort of larger epidemiologic studies looking at this. And I don't think they're conclusive yet. But, you know, there are some interesting animal studies that suggest that if you give somebody artificial sweeteners, some rat, I guess, some artificial sweeteners, they tend actually to eat and drink more after that. because it sort of fools their appetite systems into thinking they're getting a lot of calories with sweeteners in it.
Mm-hmm. Christina in Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
I think this is a great discussion that you all are having. I think this needs to be discussed more. I'm a parent of three children, one of whom who has a disability, and I think the food has just been crucial in terms of this healing. And so, I'm wondering why we aren't questioning more the subsidies of corn and soybeans, where, I mean, it's too expensive for an average American family to eat real food with real ingredients, not processed. It's cheaper for me to, drive down the street and get fast food. But we find that, when our kids are actually eating food that, I cook at home with organic ingredients, that their health improves. I mean, mm-hmm. I think any discussion about obesity in America has got to start with policy that's going to talk about, changing what the American family can afford.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about obesity this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato with Dr. Erica Lubetkin and Dr. Matthew Gilman. Dr. Gilman, any reaction to that?
A very interesting comment. Our U.S. Department of Agriculture was not really set up as a health agency, and a lot of it is set up to actually support industry. And it hasn't been surprising, I don't think, over the years that, the farm bills and other bills that have come out have really, supported production, mm-hmm. but haven't really looked at the health impact. And I think, there's more talk now, both in scientific as well as political circles, about relooking at these issues and seeing whether, whether we squeeze the balloon in one area, it really pops out in another, and you have the law of unintended effects. So if you mm-hmm. produce more sugar or corn, that it may be good in the short term for the farmers, but not good in the long term for the health of the public.
Mm-hmm. Christina asks about the subsidizing and how it's more expensive, but in some places, in Erica, you can't even buy healthy foods in some inner city stores and some supermarkets. It's not even there, even if you want to pay for it.
Right. There's a lot of disparities in terms of neighborhood effects. And where I work, which is Hamilton Heights, Upper Harlem, there's a lot of bodegas. And it's much harder to access those fruits and vegetables and healthy foods. There's a lot of processed foods. And certainly there's been more of a movement in terms of having farmers, green markets coming and delivering fruits and vegetables and having people have a means to pay for it. But certainly access to date has been a big issue.
Mm-hmm. You look at photographs of inner city grocery stores, sometimes all you can see is soda. You have to pick apart the aisles to get anything else. Mm-hmm. Maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but it sure seems like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, might people argue, well, if there were a demand for it, they would have it in the store? I mean, then again, if in those stores it would be so expensive, you probably couldn't afford it without having some sort of subsidy, I would think. Having been in lots of those stores.
Yeah, I think we may come back to these issues of, chicken and egg. Mm-hmm. And if we live in a society where we're bombarded with media messages about eating more and eating bigger portion sizes, and that's what faces us when we go out our doors, and that's what role models do, it's hard to pin it on the demand side of it.
And it's also different with regard to children and adults, where with children, those messages are just so in front of them in terms of, walking by a McDonald's or a fast food and seeing the Happy Meal and the product and that marketing to kids and being so susceptible, or going to the drugstores and seeing all the candy on the lower shelf where a child, it's marketed of a movie or some other character. And so, as a parent, mm-hmm. With our two kids, we feel very strongly in terms of it's so out there and accessible and so familiar mm-hmm. in terms of that recognition.
So are you, the 10 years from now when we get to that point, are you hopeful or not hopeful about the future?
Well, slow and steady. I think that the gains with smoking, which were, it decreased by about 18.5% over the last 16 years, but New York City in particular has just done a wonderful job, but they also used taxation. They used a number of different policies, mm-hmm. Education, a lot of mass media, provider. They gave nicotine replacement therapy. They did a multi-pronged approach, and it's, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Gilman, you hopeful?
I am, and part of the reason is that there have been some recent national data suggesting that the epidemic may have started to peak, and at least in some demographic subgroups, like white women, may be starting to come down.
All right. We've run out of time. I want to thank both of you for joining us, Dr. Matthew Gilman of Harvard Med School, Dr. Erica Lubitkin, who is at City College of New York here in New York City. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
We're going to change course a little, change topics, and talk about storing CO2 in a bubbly rock. And it's also stuff that's being done here and maybe coming to a neighborhood near you. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. If you had to find a place for a billion tons of carbon dioxide, where would you stash it? Not in your closet. Why not rocks? Yeah. Scientists are reporting in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and they say that basalt formations deep within the sea floor could work as CO2 sponges. They estimate that one basalt basin right here in Sandy Hook, New Jersey, right at the gateway to New York City, there's enough basalt there that they could hold roughly 40 years worth of emissions from four coal-fired power plants. Well, of course, if we can do that, how do we get the CO2 into the rock? Why won't it leak out? Well, here to tell us more about it is Paul Olson. Dr. Olson is the Arthur D. Stork Memorial Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, and author of the study, coming from just up the road a piece, right? Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan.
Yep. Thank you. Well, let's talk about what is basalt and why is that a good place to store it?
Basalt is hardened lava. When lava comes out and pours on the Earth's surface, it cools rather rapidly. The upper surface is foamy because there's gas in the basalt. Mm-hmm. And it hardens into a rock we call basalt.
And it's the stuff you can see just driving around.
In the East Coast, many of the quarries from which we get crushed rock to make roads are in basalt. Ancient lava flows about 200 million years old.
Mm-hmm. So your idea is to find this layer of the bubbly. It's not really foamy. It looks foamy.
It looks like
lava.
That's right. It is lava.
Very hard lava, not the kind we have in Hawaii that's floating on the water. Is it sort of denser?
Well,
water?
Actually, the foamy part is very much like
is
the pumice
right?
that would be floating on water. It's not quite that foamy, but it's close.
And there's enough of it around that you could pump in CO2 and it would soak it up like a sponge.
Every place that there were these ancient lava flows, the top of every single one is foamy. Mm-hmm. There are also fractures in the rock as well, and that means there's pore space in the foam and in the fractures, and it's a place you could store CO2.
And how far down below the ground would you have to find it?
It occurs at the surface, but it also occurs underground as well, and there are several places, many places, in fact, off the Atlantic coast where it's thousands of feet underground, under the seafloor, actually, and where you could safely store this stuff. It's abundant. It's easy to get to. It has known rather simple properties. So it's kind of an ideal place to do it.
This place you talk about, Sandy Hook, which is right out here in Jersey, you studied that place and you found that you could store a vast amount. I mentioned how much CO2?
Well, enough, 40 years worth.
40 years worth.
40 years worth from four coal burning power plants. But remember, that's a very crude estimate. We don't really know that much about what's under Sandy Hook. There are some geophysical measurements of what's under there, and it's a guess that there's basalt under there. We know that basalt's abundant up and down the East Coast. It's probably there, but you'd have to drill to find out for sure.
And something fascinating happens when you pump the CO2 into the rock.
Oh, that's one of the things that's very special about basalt. It has calcium and magnesium silicates that react with the carbon dioxide to form another compound, which is basically calcium carbonate, and that's just common limestone. So people have talked about storing CO2 in rocks before. Mostly they're talking about places that gas or oil has been extracted from. There's known pore space in the rock, and you'd pump down CO2 and store it in that kind of reservoir. Those can leak through time. Any reservoir can. Mm-hmm. However, if you put it in basalt, the reaction with the basalt makes the reservoir more and more stable through time instead of unstable.
So over time, the CO2 morphs into this limestone. Yes. So it's locked up forever.
It's locked up forever. It becomes inert. It would not be released into the atmosphere again until that crust got subducted in 60 or 70 million years, just like limestone does in seafloor normally.
Wow. And did the CO2 start out in that?
Well, that's one of the really sort of fascinating ironies, is that the CO2 that's in the atmosphere ultimately comes from deep in the earth, and basalt is one of the places it comes out of. So where you have lava pouring out on the surface of the earth, that's where CO2 is coming back into the atmosphere, because all the time there are processes that remove it. And if CO2 didn't go back in, it would eventually be consumed and all plants would die, and then that would be the end of life on Earth. But instead what happens is the places that lava comes out constantly adds little bits of CO2 all the time. So it's and real irony if we're going to pump it right back in where it came from.
Mm-hmm. So over time, though, if you're pumping this stuff into the foamy basalt and it's turning it into calcium carbonate, into limestone, aren't you going to fill up that spot?
Yes. Eventually you would fill it up. But, you know, you'd fill it up anyway with the carbon dioxide, and you have to move to another place. The important thing is that it stabilizes itself through time with a very benign substance.
Where did all this come from? Where did all this basalt come from?
That's a really interesting story. The basalt came from an eruption, a series of eruptions that occurred between Eastern North America, Africa, and South America 200 million years ago, when all the continents reunited in the supercontinent Pangaea, and they began to split up. And what's really amazing about these particular lavas is they came out over an enormous area, 11 million square kilometers, one-third the area of the moon. And it came out in less than 600,000 years and spread over this gigantic area. So much CO2 was released in that process that it probably resulted in a mass extinction that killed off about 50% of all plant and animal life on the Earth.
Wow. So that basalt is still there, waiting for us to go back and put the CO2 back in.
Yes.
That came out.
Right, exactly. The CO2 that we're breathing now and plants are using to make their tissue, that CO2 is partly coming from the burning of fossil fuels and not coming from the basalt. The CO2 that was poured out in the atmosphere 200 million years ago, that's been recycled many times already in the Earth system.
Here's a tweet coming in from M. Tatter wants to know, what are the downsides? Is there any danger of the basalt carbon interconnection?
There is no danger to the basalt conversion into limestone. There are always risks when you're drilling that occur all the time when you're drilling into rock, but they're very small risks, less risks than you'd have when you're drilling for hydrocarbons, for example. Furthermore, of course, when you drill down into the crust, then there's pore space at depth that isn't empty. There's something there. There's water.
Right.
Now, that water is generally salty at depth. If you drill on land and you put CO2 down there into basalt, which is certainly possible, the problem is you then have to dispose of the water that you're displacing. If you do this in the ocean, you're displacing seawater that's in the basalt, and it's just seawater and seawater, which is fairly benign. So that's why the seawater, the ocean is a better place to put this than on land.
It's also a better place, as you say, because it's really deep and the pressure of the water.
That's right.
Is
Then what the pressure of the water and the depth in the crust allows you to do, it allows you to store CO2 in a liquid form, and at the right depth, it is actually heavier than water.
You don't have to chill it down or anything.
You have to compress it.
The water will compress it.
Yes, that's right. So at that pressure, it'll be liquid and it'll be heavier than water, so it won't have a tendency to rise up, which is another advantage of putting it in the oceans.
So if any of it leaks out, it's just going to stay down there.
Yeah, that's right. And the basalt reaction to the limestone through time makes it inert and incapable of moving again.
So this would be an answer to people who say, well, if we have to sequester CO2, if we can scrub it out of our coal-fired power plants, where are we going to put it? We can put it in these basalt formations.
Probably basalt formations are not going to solve the whole problem. One of the greatest problems we have with this is transportation. You want it to be close to the sources of CO2, or at least close to scrubbers. It's possible, for example, to remove CO2 directly from the atmosphere rather than the more efficient way of removing it directly from the source of a power plant or so. But the big cost of it is getting to where you want to sequester it.
But what's interesting about your discovery, we're right in a giant metropolitan area where you might create a power plant and you don't have to move it very far. Couldn't you just drill down the CO2, take it right out and put it right down into the basalt.
That's the
right
basic
where
idea.
We need it.
You'd probably want to pipe it offshore
right.
a distance and then put it in the ground. But the advantage of these particular rocks is they're so common that almost every single major city on the East Coast, there's some of this offshore.
You know, sometimes things sound too good to be true.
There's a lot of basalt. Not every place you drill is going to be the right place. You have to have enough porosity and permeability to allow
right.
the stuff to be stored. We don't have enough experimental experience to know how easy or hard this process is going to be. There has to be a program of getting samples specifically in places that this basalt exists. There have to be tests. We're very far, not enormously far, not decades and decades, but we need to do enough research to be able to really understand the system before we go willy-nilly starting storing the stuff.
And that's what you're doing. You're doing that basic
yes,
research.
That's what we're trying to do.
And you need to do more of it.
A lot more. The most difficult part is getting the samples of rock to work on and getting the holes in the right setting to do the actual tests. It's quite expensive, and it's experimental.
And you have boreholes in various places?
Well, my colleagues at Lamont Dowdy Earth Observatory, which is part of Columbia, have done tests of at Lamont. In Palisades, New York, in the Palisades sill, which is some lava that never got out of the ground, basically. And so some of those tests have actually been done, but it's still very much in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring on Flora Lichtman, our video producer, who's here with us. And I know that Flora is going to talk about a video pick of the week, which is you went out
yes,
on a field trip.
Dr. Olson took us out to a basalt quarry in New Jersey. And so we actually saw the types of rock that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. You sort of gave us a tour guide. You took him out, and he's like a tour guide showing us the different layers.
Yeah, what was amazing to me was actually that the differences between the basalt, so the bubbly basalt versus the non-bubbly, mm-hmm. you know, because you want to pump it into the holy one, basically.
Right.
You could actually see it. I mean, it was visibly different. And we saw that intersection between these two types of basalt when we were in the quarry.
Mm-hmm. And there was a special layer that you were showing her in the video. If you go to our video at sciencefriday.com, you look at the video on the pick of the week in the lab, you'll see the terrific video with Dr. Olson there. It's better to have a cap on it,
yes,
saying in the video?
Yes, well, you have to have some kind of seal on that bubbly surface, otherwise the carbon dioxide would just move around, and you don't want it to move around. You want it to sit right there where it will react with the basalt. So another lava flow on top is usually a lot less bubbly at the bottom than it is at the top, so that provides a very convenient seal. And by the way, that's another advantage to putting this stuff offshore, where there's a thick pile of much younger clay-rich sediments to keep that entire package of basalt under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
But in this quarry, you could see that bubbly surface beautifully, and you could hold it in your hands, and you could see the size of the bubbles, about an eighth inch across each, and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of these. And we have taken samples of that basalt, and mm-hmm. we've looked at how much porosity there is, and it's about 10 to 15% of open space in that rock.
Talking about this carbon sequestration in basalt this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. Here with Dr. Paul Olson of Lamont Dowdy Earth Observatory and with Flora Lichtman, our video producer.
One thing that you were talking about when we were in the quarry is that how that bubbly layer was formed, and I thought that was pretty interesting. So how does that happen?
Well, the lava, as it comes up through the Earth's crust, is being under less and less pressure. And there are dissolved gases in the magma as it's rising through the Earth's crust. The pressure is released. It starts literally to boil. The gases come out of solution. They form bubbles. The bubbles are rising to the top, and they make a foam. But the basalt's also cooling, so that the foam gets frozen in place. And that's what we were looking at in the quarry, this foamy surface.
It was like a basalt float.
Yes. Basalt Sunday.
A basalt Sunday. So the basalt of the earth, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, you've heard that a few times.
A few times.
Shucks.
And then what is the cap? What actually was on top of it? Why is the layer on top not bubbly?
Because it's the layer on top isn't bubbly because the lava flow is heavy. So the bottom part's under greater pressure than the top part, which is open to the air. Mm. So the bubbles go to the top. There are some bubbles that are at the bottom, especially if the basalt heats what's under it enough and the water that's absorbed in the rock below steams up and pops up through the into the basalt. And we saw some of those little pipes and vessels too. But there are far fewer of those than the bubbles that are on top of the flow.
Do you have to have an area of geology where there was a rift and this volcanic action?
You don't have to have a rift valley, but off New Jersey and in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Connecticut and Massachusetts, there were such rifts, and they hold enormous volumes of rock. Some of the single lava flows are over 600 feet thick. Mm-hmm. So they're enormous. Mm-hmm. And the foamy parts can be 50 or 60 feet thick and covered thousands of square kilometers.
So, Flora, when we see your video pick of the week, we're going to see you taking a tour with Dr. Olson on the rock.
We'll see Dr. Olson leading a tour. How do these rocks relate to the Palisades? I think people have seen the Palisades as sort of photogenic on the –
Hudson.
Hard to miss when crossing the George Washington Bridge or the Tappan Zee. And what you're looking at is a cross-section caused by relatively modern erosion of what's called a sill. A sill is a body of igneous rock that was molten and injected into previously existing older material. It spreads out horizontally like squeezing toothpaste between two pieces of bread, or I guess you'd want to squeeze peanut butter, not toothpaste. Mm-hmm. But in any case, you squeeze it into the bread and it makes a little sandwich. And that magma never made it to the surface. It's compositionally the same as the basalt flows, but it lacks a bubbly layer. It has fractures in it that could, in fact, hold CO2. That's why we did the test at Lamont. But it doesn't have a foamy layer, so it's not ideal.
Mm. That foamy layer is the secret.
That's the key, and you can see it, actually.
On our video, Science Friday's Pick of the Week at sciencefriday.com, that little video, our new video up there on the left side, just click on it and watch the tour of the quarry. Are the quarries like that? Or is that a typical quarry in that part of New Jersey?
It's a very typical quarry because the basalt, often called trap rock, is a valuable resource and an important resource because it's hard. It meets engineering specifications for hardness and compressibility, mm-hmm. and it's an ideal material to mix into cement or tar to make roads.
And one great part of the video is that Flora is showing that you're holding an actual piece of basalt that started the transition to have the limestone in it.
That's right. Under quite common conditions, that transformation of basalt to limestone occurs in nature. It can occur in the ground if there's very rich water, very rich in carbon dioxide circulating, or more commonly in arid areas, it forms on the surface, and you'll get a crust of limestone right on top of the basalt.
Pretty black rock with all that white specks in it.
That's right.
Thank you, Dr. Olson, very much. Fascinating.
My pleasure.
Dr. Paul Olson is a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. And Flora Lichtman was here with our video pick of the week. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and watch the tour of that quarry with all that basalt. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata, senior producer Ned Heist. Charles Berquist is our director, and Flora is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our SciArts producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director, spinning the dials here in New York, and we had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. You can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where Flora Lichtman's video pick of the week is up there. Lots of good basalt of the earth there to take a look at, and also, we're podcasting, Twittering at SciFry all week. So join us and be part of the crowd. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Have you ever heard of fracking? Fracking. It's short for hydraulic fracturing, and it's a process that blasts water, sand, and chemicals into underground rock deposits to release natural gas. And fracking has mostly been used in the western United States, but new discoveries of gas-rich rock in a formation called the Marcellus Shale, which stretches from New York down through Pennsylvania into West Virginia, could mean a lot more fracking in a lot more places, and it has created quite a controversy. Some people are worried about what fracking can do to groundwater or what to do with the wastewater that it is produced. Does it find its way? Are there spills on the drilling sites into streams and places like that? What does it do to the wildlife in those areas? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, the progress and the politics of of the process. And my guests are Gwen Latulk. She is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, and she joins us from Durango, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Kathleen Skama is the Director of Government Affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States in Denver. And thank you for being with us today, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Tell us how fracking is done.
Well, we drill a well for natural gas or oil, and we drill down several thousand feet into a source rock layer containing natural gas or oil. And we may drill horizontally through that rock layer. And because of the intense pressure and because of the depth that we're drilling at, it's not easy for the natural gas to flow from that source rock into the wellbore. So we do a process called hydraulic fracture stimulation, whereby we pump water and sand and some chemicals, a mixture of those, down in through the wellbore, and into down below ground into the source rock, and literally try to crack that open. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're lucky if we can get some horizontal cracks about, a few hundred feet out if we're lucky mm-hmm. Because of the intense pressure. But it's important to note that before we do that fracturing process, we've cemented and cased that wellbore. So there's a steel pipe that runs the length of that well. There's cement around that to ensure that nothing can go from the wellbore to any adjacent layers or into an aquifer. So it's a very safe process. It's been used in over 60 years in over 1 million wells across the United States.
So what happens when something does go wrong and you have these spills of thousands of gallons of the drilling fluid out onto the surface?
Well, there are regulations in place. States heavily regulate every process involved with fracturing or with drilling a well. So if there is an accident, there are measures in place to make sure that's cleaned up and to handle that. You know, we work very hard to ensure the environmental impact is very minimal.
Mm-hmm, because we've had reports of various states of up to 8,000 gallons spilled out into the area. There have been reports of fish dying in creeks and places where the water and the chemicals have impacted the environment.
Right. There was a case, Dunkards Creek in Pennsylvania, that was blamed on natural gas, and it turns out it was a coal mine discharge. So there are lots of anecdotes out there.
It's not what I read in the other sources. They don't agree with you, obviously.
Well, don't take my word for it then. The EPA under the Clinton, Bush, and now the Obama administration has repeated that there have been no cases of contamination of drinking water from hydraulic fracturing, and state regulators in all the states that have oil and gas development have also made that point.
Well, I'm not talking about the drinking water. I'm talking about the creeks and the spillage that comes out of the site.
Again, as I was saying, there are regulations in place to handle that. If an unfortunate accident does occur, the company's responsible for cleaning that up. Mm-hmm. And that was the case recently in Pennsylvania where there was a spill mm-hmm. and it was handled accordingly.
Kathleen, what problem do you have with all of this?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. You know, we've been developing natural gas and oil in this country for over 150 years.
Yeah, so you're
the last 60 of which we've been using hydraulic fracturing with an exemplary safety record.
Mm-hmm. Gwen Lackalt, you are concerned that we really don't know what's in some of these chemicals being pumped in there.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, I'm a community organizer by training with a degree in political science, and I can tell you that fracturing is a big political issue, and we don't really have the science, and it's turned into a game of he said, she said. And we really do need the science. We need the EPA to conduct a comprehensive study of the practice, and we need to require companies to disclose the chemical constituents that they use in drilling and fracturing fluids.
Well, you mean we don't know what's in those chemicals? What the chemicals are?
That's correct. And industry has for years stood behind what they called trade secrets, and that they don't want to disclose their recipe, if you will, for fracturing fluids. Mm-hmm. And our position is you know, that's fine. Coca-Cola, the Coca-Cola recipe is secret, but we know what the ingredients are. Those ingredients are listed on the side of the can, and we believe the same needs to be true for communities that face oil and gas development.
What kind of ingredients do we know of? Do we know about some of them?
Well, some of the chemicals are disclosed on material safety data sheets that we've been able to get from our local fire stations, and those list everything from trade names like Zetaflow and all sorts of propants and gels, and that benzene, toluene, ethylene glycol, that those are some of the things that are contained in fracturing fluids.
When you have a hazardous material spill, don't the fire department, don't they like to know what they're going to be cleaning up when they come and clean it up?
Exactly. They need to know what they're dealing with. So a lot of those chemicals have to be disclosed on these MSDS, mm-hmm. material safety data sheets, but those lists aren't complete, and we need to have full disclosure of the chemicals used in these operations so emergency responders know what they're going to be dealing with once they arrive at a site where there may be an incident.
Kathleen, what would be wrong with that, with the disclosure of all the chemicals?
Absolutely nothing, because that's the current case today. On a well site, you have all the material safety data sheets for every chemical that's contained on that site. We comply with all regulations as far as that goes. If you would like a list, everything is disclosed. Pennsylvania and New York State's environmental departments both have a comprehensive list of chemicals. The Groundwater mm-hmm. Protection Council, which is a body of state regulators, also publishes a list of the chemicals used, and certainly in the event of an accident, those material data safety data sheets are handed to responders and are on site exactly for that reason. And the specifics are available to regulators who are responsible for ensuring it's environmentally sound.
Gwen, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's exactly why we need to pass a bill that's before Congress today. It's called the FRAC Act, the Fracturing Responsibility and Awareness of Chemicals Act. And that bill would set a federal floor, and it would require that fracturing be regulated and that chemicals be disclosed. And currently, we do not have every state in the country does not regulate the practice of hydraulic fracturing, and we have 32 oil and gas producing states. So this bill would set a federal floor. States are welcome to pass mm-hmm. additional regulations governing fracturing.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen, you say that despite Pennsylvania citing the Cabot Oil and Gas Company last February, I'm reading from a Forbes article, for contaminating wells used for drinking near drill sites, you're going to stick with your line that none of this gets contaminated.
Right. There's been no case of contamination of drinking water from fracturing in its 60-year history. And as for disclosure and regulation, all the states who have oil and gas already regulate the process very heavily. If they want to add more laws for disclosure, as New York is set to do, they can certainly do that. But, it's regulated heavily today.
Mm-hmm. Gwen, any final words?
Well, our position is that hydraulic fracturing is an unregulated practice. And in 2005, due to heavy industry lobbying, the Congress exempted the practice of hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And companies are not required to disclose the chemical constituents, with the exception of a new requirement in Colorado. So no one is actually monitoring for contamination. And until we have full public disclosure, we won't know what chemicals to test for when there is an incident. So because this practice is unregulated and we don't know what chemicals to test for, we haven't seen what the issues really are or potentially mm-hmm. could be from this practice.
That's just not true. We are subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. We have been since 1974 when the act was put in place. The only thing that we are not is Safe Drinking Water Act does not require fracking specifically to be under a particular underground injection control permit program. But as far as handling the materials at the top of the at the surface and the wastewater, that's all handled in accordance
but,
with the
But there's no regulations for underground, as
Absolutely.
You're saying.
Each
you're, saying
state
the EPA, you're saying that just for the stuff that's above the ground. There's no EPA regulations.
There is not, because the states are regulating it that now, and the EPA under the last three administrations has said that they don't need to regulate it and that it is a safe practice.
That might change with this bill coming up. Who knows? We'll see. Thank you. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Gwen Leckholt is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. She was in Durango, Colorado. And Kathleen Scama is the director of government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States. She was in Denver. Thank you all, and have a good weekend to you.
You too.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with one of my favorite guys. Dr. Eric Kandel is here. He's going to talk about, well, he just turned 80. Happy birthday. And also is a new film out. He stars in his own documentary film, which is an interesting take. Maybe he's going into the movie business. We'll talk about him. You know, he's won the Nobel Prize, and so there's a lot to talk about. 1-800-989-8255. Vera Kandel up after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, the star of a new movie who in all likelihood will never be mistaken for George Clooney. But then again, George Clooney will never win a Nobel Prize. My next guest has spent the last 50 years studying the molecular basis of memory in sea slugs and mice. He's a You know him. He's won the Nobel Prize in 2000. Most people would slow down after all of that, but he's not taking a break. Dr. Eric Kandel is senior investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's a university professor at Columbia University and the Fred Kavli Professor and director of the Kavli Institute for Brain Science. And his movie is premiering. Is it tonight, Dr. Kandel?
Tonight.
Tonight, In Search of Memory. Where is it? Where is it premiering?
The International Film Center on 6th Avenue and 3rd Street.
And why a new movie at this point in your career?
I didn't think of it as a new point in my career or as a new movie. I wrote a book called In Search of Memory, and Petra Seeger, the filmmaker, read the book, liked it, and asked me whether I would be interested in doing a documentary. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I had planned to celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary with our children and grandchildren by taking a sentimental journey through the places where we were born and we were raised, including hiding in the south of France for Denise. Hitler occupied Vienna for me, and we suggested she come along. So this was a family trip. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she came along, and she very creatively switched back and forth between autobiographical aspects of my life and what is happening in my lab. She came and she visited the lab for a week. So it was really effortless. There was no script. There was no rehearsal. Nothing was done twice. Mm-hmm. And even though I was intensely uncomfortable the first time I saw the film. Have you ever been in a movie? It's very very awkward seeing yourself.
I've been on television, been on TV quite a number of times.
And well, it's
been
different.
Embarrassed about it, but you're right. In a film, it's
in a
high
film,
definition.
You're more natural. but I've seen it now several times and becoming more comfortable with it. And to my great delight, there's a good response to it.
Yeah, 1-800-989-8255, talking with Eric Kandel. Also, you can Twitter us. Our tweet is at SciFright, at SCIFRI. The new film is called In Search of Memory. And it does go back and forth between your professional and your personal life. And is memory something you're still searching for?
Oh, absolutely.
Where are we now? Give us a little thumbnail sketch of where are we in history or in medicine about knowing what memory is.
Well, memory is an extremely difficult problem, and we're nowhere near having a complete understanding of it. On the other hand, in the last 50 years, we've gone from having a very limited biological understanding to a respectable beginning. This is not simply the work of a single person. It's a work of a field which has three components: very good cognitive psychology, good neuroscience and molecular biology. And these three disciplines have emerged in sort of a new science of memory. And we now understand how short-term memory is laid down, how it's converted to a long-term memory, and how memory is retained for long periods of time, and how different regions of the brain are involved in storing different kinds of memories.
Mm-hmm. And you've been instrumental in actually looking at individual nerve cells, neurons, and their connections, and you've discovered what goes on in the cell. What goes on in the cell to create a memory?
Well, we found that what is critical is that the connections between nerve cells, the point where one cell communicates with another, is not fixed, but can be modified by learning. And when you produce a short-term memory, you modify that connection transiently, and you don't see any anatomical change. It's a functional change, a biochemical change within the cells. But if you produce a long-term memory, like if you remember our conversation tomorrow, mm-hmm. it's because anatomical changes will have occurred in your brain in the connections between nerve cells, and there's actually a growth of new synaptic connections with mm-hmm. long-term memory. And we can trace this in detail.
What starts the growth of new terms?
That's a very good question. What we found is that when you produce a short-term memory, it not only establishes a functional change, but it sends a signal back to the nucleus to turn on genes. And these genes turn on other genes that give rise to proteins that give rise to the growth of new synaptic connections. So you can actually follow the movement of molecules mm-hmm. from the nucleus out to the synapse. It's a communication between the nucleus and the synapse.
Would anybody have thought of that years ago besides you? Yeah, I mean, what?
I was not the only one to think about it. So let's put this into context. A giant, perhaps the most important giant in all of neuroscience, is a guy called Ramoni Cajal. Mm-hmm. And he suggested in 1896 that maybe long-term memory involves the growth of new connections.
Right.
So that idea was around. It was not the only idea. There were other ideas, and there was no way of knowing at time zero which of several attractive ideas are out. So you've got to do the experiments. One didn't know specifically the genes are regulated, but we knew from other people's work, not my own, that long-term memory differed fundamentally from short-term memory in requiring the synthesis of new proteins.
Right.
So as molecular biology came along, you could see what kind of synthesis required. So I could be the first one to show genes are switched on, which particular gene, it's something called CREB, cyclic AMP response element binding protein, that's mumbo jumbo, so saying a regulator of gene expression is turned on. But there was some intellectual background. It wasn't a mm-hmm. complete jungle.
But that implies when a gene is turned on, there's some permanency to it.
That's right. That's right.
That's the difference between short-term and
that's
long-term
exactly
memory.
That's exactly correct, Ira. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And how can you reverse that permanency?
Yes, there are things that turn that off. Mm-hmm. For example, with time, certain kinds of long-term memories wear off. If you send an opposing signal in at the same time, you can shut off the growth of new synaptic connections. There are a lot of inhibitory constraints on memory. Mm-hmm. So if you activate them, you can prevent what normally would be a memory storage from occurring.
There was some news out this week in some research papers about that actually light can influence neuron brain cells. I mean, there was different colors of light turning things on.
Well, certainly light coming in through the retina can influence them dramatically mm-hmm. because color is a very powerful motivator for people.
Right.
In addition, there are now experimental techniques whereby you can shine light onto
right.
nerve cells and activate them selectively or shut them off.
How could you make use of that if the nerve cells would be inside your brain?
Well, you have to implant the light guide into
the brain.
And this is not for people. This is experimental
yeah.
work in experimental animal. It's called channel rhodopsin, in which you have a light-sensitive ion channel that can either activate a nerve cell or shut it off. It's a very powerful technique for studying how neural circuits work in the brain.
Mm-hmm. And now, where is the frontier in memory?
Well, there are many frontiers. One is, how do we recall memory? We know very little about the recall process, number one. Number two, almost every major psychiatric disorder has a memory deficit with it. The most obvious cases are Alzheimer's disease or age-related memory loss, which is a non-Alzheimer form of memory. What goes wrong under these circumstances and how can we reverse those processes? But in addition, schizophrenia has a defect in working memory. Depression has a severe defect in memory storage. Anxiety states, post-traumatic stress, too much memory. You know, I remember too well what happened to me in Vienna. So there are a variety of disturbances of memory storage that we would like to understand better so we can intervene more effectively for medical good.
Now, if I were your shrink or your psychiatrist at this moment, I would say, why did you bring that up? I remember too much what happened to me in Vienna. Do you remember too much what happened to you in Vienna?
I don't consciously think it that way.
Yeah.
But when I examine my life and I see how often I've come back to themes that started in Vienna, I'm doing a book now on art and science, and it's focused on the fact that unconscious psychological process of Viennese discovery were discovered independently by Freud, Schnitzler, and three Austrian painters, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele. Now, why is a nice Jewish boy like me going back to this? So I can give you a half a dozen examples of this kind.
But you don't have such great memories of Vienna.
No.
They're painful memories.
Very
painful.
But
the Nazis coming in and it's part of your film.
I was 8 years old when Hitler came into Vienna, and the crowds streamed into the streets welcoming him and turned against the Jews in the most brutal way. And Vienna as a city is very beautiful, and the government of Austria is very progressive at this point, but there's still strong remnants of anti-Semitism, which I can sense in certain parts of the country.
Still?
Yes.
Still. So why did you go back? Why did you take the film crew back?
I actually went back at first time for scientific reasons. I was invited to come back, and I found it very difficult to come back. I found it easy in Germany, where for historical reasons, Germany was declared a defeated nation that had participated in the Holocaust. And people were honest about, they were forced to be honest, and they were honest about the history.
Mm-hmm.
For complicated historical reasons, Austria was defined as a victim. And therefore, they could play down their active role in the Hitler period, which was an extremely active role. There were more Austrians per capita of Austria leading concentration camps than there were Germans. And there was a long history of anti-Semitism in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
Very famous mayor of Vienna, a guy called Luega, who was the first one to develop political anti-Semitism, realized that anti-Semitism is a very successful political platform. If you get the population angry at people who have education or financial resources, this can be very successful for getting poor people agitated. So there were historical roots for this. But I like to think that maybe at this particular point where people listen to me, I can be useful in bringing about change.
And what kind of change now that you have the stage?
I'm trying to do several things. One is Luega, the mayor of Vienna, has a part of the Ringstrasse named after him. That would be bad enough, but the part of the Ringstrasse that's named after him happens to be the very place where the University of Vienna, the citadel of morality in a state, sits, the most important university in Austria. And I find that unacceptable. And I'm trying to encourage people to see it that way and to change the name of it to University Ring or something like that, number one. Number two, I'm trying to help certain scientific organizations in Vienna grow.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I like to do this is because I would like them to establish routes for encouraging Jewish immigration so that one can reestablish a vibrant Jewish community in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Eric Kandel on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and Dr. Kandel has a new film premiering tonight, In Search of Memory, based on his book in which he went back to Vienna and looked at your roots, painful memories, and decided, as you're telling me now, things that you would like to have changed? You, two out of three. What is the third?
I think I mentioned all three. To change the Neuregring, right, to build the scientific community in Austria, and to use that as a vehicle for bringing Jewish students in and energizing the Jewish community in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. And you think you're making progress with these things?
Our progress and political scheme is slower than scientific progress, if it's possible.
If it's possible at all. It's easier to do something in science than it is to do in politics.
Absolutely. There's no question about
that. And that shows the resistance that you're saying to still the anti-Semitic resistance you feel in Vienna.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Getting that. When you went back, and your father owned a store?
My father owned a small toy store in Vienna. And the location of that store is still there. And a wonderful woman who now sort of runs a small delicatessen luncheonette out of there really remembers the fact that this is my father's store, has a picture of my book in the window, which is quite touching. And this is a woman who's, you and I would be completely comfortable with, just a wonderful human being. So I must say, I mean, Vienna has changed a lot. I'm saying there is still islands of difficulty, but there is a movement in the right direction.
And in the film In Search of Memory, you take us actually into
that little store.
any remnants of your father? Was it like you remember when you were a kid?
The door is the same, and she said that they have all agreed that the door will not change.
But everything else is just about different. Talking with Eric Kandel, author of In Search of Memory, now the new movie that's debuting. 1-800-989-8255. We've got a whole rest of the hour to talk to him about this. Is there anything you would change about your life? Or any direction different of your research you would change? Life is all taking different paths.
Well, I must say I think that my life has been extremely fortunate. I mean, the most fortunate thing is I ended up in America. I mean, this is a spectacular country. I think a number of refugees like myself actually were slow to see weaknesses in the American position, for example, in Vietnam, because we thought for the longest time, this country is perfect. And I would say that even though this country has done bad things, has made mistakes, at its worst moments, this is a fairly wonderful place to live. So number one, I was very fortunate with that. Number two, the way one moves ahead in society is through education. Mm-hmm. This has always been important for Jews, and I was sensitive to that. And I was very lucky to have a wonderful education. I went to a parochial school to begin with, but then I went to a public high school, Erasmus, where I had a spectacular education, a wonderful experience in which my high school teacher actually gave me the money to apply to Harvard. I mean, can you think of that?
That's from Brooklyn,
So, and I went to Harvard. I had a great education. I decided at the spur of the moment that because of a woman friend that I formed a friendship with, that I would go to medical school to become a psychoanalyst. I'd been majoring in intellectual history.
Right. Came from Vienna, too. So.
Fits again. Yeah. And I went to medical school with the idea of becoming a psychoanalyst. And I took an elective in neurobiology and found, boy, I like this even more than psychoanalysis. Yeah, this is the future. I was completely incompetent as a neurobiologist. But because of this minimal training, I was selected by the NIH as an alternative to the draft. I had 3 years of wonderful training.
Now we'll go on from that, talking with Dr. Eric Kandel. He is stars in his new film that's premiering tonight, In Search of Memory, opens today. Also the topic of his book, Nobel Prize winner 2000. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about memory with my guest, Eric Kandel, senior investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, a university professor at Columbia University. How long have you been at Columbia? Like forever.
I've been at Columbia since 1974. Columbia is the most fantastic place. I just feel privileged to be there.
And
And in my field, it's just superb.
It is. And they've encouraged you and supported you.
They've given me tremendous freedom. They've given me tremendous support, both, you know, intellectual support and personal support.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dr. Kandel's film is opening in New York today, In Search of Memories. I hope it gets to other places around the country.
I hope it will. So, I hope it will. One of the things I like about the film, this is self-promotion.
That's good. That's what we're all here for.
Is that, and actually this is a Columbia theme. This is not unique with me. Lee Bollinger, our president, really enunciated this a long time ago, that science is part of culture. You're a perfect example of this, Ira. There's no reason why the most arcane subject in science can't be explained so all of us can understand it. And I think it's very important to communicate science to other people. And the film does this in a very modest way. This is important for several reasons. One is the workforce in science is small. And that's for two reasons. People think that this is not economically the most profitable way to have a life. I think that's misleading. Granted, my salary is not comparable to a major person on Wall Street, but the quality of my life is remarkably good. I mean, I get invited to meetings all over the world. Mm-hmm. I get invited to dinners and things like this, not only at this particular point in my life, but throughout my career.
Right.
So I think the quality of life in a university is extremely rewarding, and it compensates for any, you know, slight decrease in salary or even significant decrease in salary you would have. But in addition, I think it's important for people to understand the science that surrounds them. We're involved in a technologically sophisticated universe. We're asked to make a decision all the time about the purity of water, the nature of memory storage. Should we interfere with it? Should we enhance it? These are difficult decisions that must be made by scientists, must be made by the community, by the public. These are not decisions that scientists can make. Scientists can recommend things, but these are public policies. And unless the public is informed, it can't make rational decisions. So I think communication of this sort on the part of many people in science is an essential feature of it. Also, we are funded by the public.
Yeah.
They support our work. They deserve and they want an explanation.
It's tough getting science news out to the public. The major media don't cover very much of it.
It's gotten better over the last decades. I mean, there's a Science Times issue every Tuesday. There's progress, but it's nowhere as strong as it should be.
I was watching all the year-end, you know, news and review shows and saw how few the paucity.
Very few.
Covered very little. You didn't think anything happened in science. All year long, right?
This is absolutely right.
Politics.
This is absolutely right.
They want 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Rona in Marble Canyon, Arizona. Where is Marble Canyon, Rona?
It's north of Flagstaff, 2.5 hours. It's almost on the Utah border, and it's spectacularly beautiful.
A little chilly there today, right?
No. We don't get. It's a little bit of a paradise in Shangri-La here.
I'm heading out.
That sounds great.
Eric and I will catch you the next plane.
Very, very hot.
Will you send
summer.
A private jet for us?
Have you got a question for Dr. Kandel?
Yes. Well, first of all, I should say I am exactly the person that you were just, that Dr. Kandel was talking about, a non-scientist. And I rely on this program.
Yes, I'm listening. Yes, I'm soaking
program.
It all in. Thank
You're
you.
In good hands with Ira.
Thank you very much.
Yes, to make me aware. And while I don't understand details, I get the concepts.
I think I
can listen to anybody intelligently. I'm not going to open my mouth and say anything. But it's very. I'm that person that Ira said, and it's exactly what my comment is, because I read In Search of Memory when it first came out, because I was a close friend of both Irving and Cheston Kupferman.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And I miss Irving terribly.
I miss Irving terribly.
And
So are you a psychoanalyst?
When they gave a party for you, and when your first book came out, I was there. You know, and I always heard them talking about you, and even way back then in the early 70s, and they said, well, you know, Eric is sure to get the Nobel Prize. I remember Irving and Tom Crewe talking.
Wow.
And
that's saying
wonderful.
That. You know, that was the estimate that the, you know, the lab people had.
Oh, that's so nice
esteem.
To hear.
You know, anyway, so I read In Search of Memory thinking I wouldn't understand anything, but I would read about you and Irving and Tom and Vincent and Lise. And your writing was so lucid and fascinating, and the diagrams were really easy to follow. And, you know, I went back and reread pages as I went along. But I did understand in exactly the way that you were just describing.
And that's
the
Kendall's
talent.
Wonderful. That's
so
that's
satisfying. But this is obviously what I try to do. And I must say I enjoy doing it. It is very satisfying to teach, to explain something to another person, and to think that somebody like you gets an insight into how the brain works as a result of this is very satisfying. And I completely agree with you. I go to a lot of lectures in which I do not understand all the details. But coming away with the key concepts is very important.
All right. Thanks. And thank you, Rona, for calling. And
that
memory.
Rona, that's wonderful.
Show,
can I
Ira.
Ask you a question before you leave? You must have lived in Port Washington. Is that right?
No, I used to visit almost every weekend.
I see.
And that's when I first learned about aplasia.
I see.
Well, and I love that picture of aplasia with the Nobel
Prize. That's one of my favorite pictures.
Yeah.
All right, Rona, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I wish I could. We're in New York for the opening, but someday I'll see this.
Right. Ask them to bring it out to your neighborhood.
If you ask, they'll probably bring it.
Thanks a lot, Rona. Take care.
Bye.
1-800-9. It's a small world.
It's
that's
amazing.
Like 2 degrees of separation.
Amazing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a few more memory questions here, because a lot of folks want to ask you. I've been hogging the air. Jim in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi there.
I'm a retired physics teacher, and I have a nice question, I think, on memory that relates to three short personal experiences. The first one was in the summer before I went to grad school, when my parents were on a vacation and I was fending for myself, I fried up some pork chops with onions. Now later, many years later, I made the same meal. And the odor of pork chops and onions is very unusual. I think it's unique, and it brought back immediately all the events around me from that summer. A friend was going into the military. I had a certain record, music in the background. I could tell you the color of shirt I was wearing. Now, the second experience is when I start up a power lawnmower where you mix the oil and the gasoline together, the odor of that immediately brings back when I was a child and my father had outboard motors.
Jim, can you speed up the question? Because I have other listeners who want to ask. So.
Yes. Is odor the best trigger for memory?
That is a wonderful question. Odor is a very, very powerful trigger of memory. And from a literary point of view, it is the most important because, as you probably know, Proust makes the point that when he dipped a Madeleine into the tea, the odor that arose from that brought back the childhood experience of having the Madeleine in tea, and the whole outpouring of his earlier memories came back to him as a result of that olfactory experience. So you're in very good company, Jim.
Thank you.
You're in a company with Proust, one of the great thinkers about memory storage.
Thanks, Jim. 1-800-989-8255. Here's a is a note coming from Second Life, an interesting one. What is it about neurons that make them so susceptible to oxygen starvation by comparison to other cell types?
Terrific question. Neurons have a big job. So most cells are relatively small and self-contained. The neuron has a part to it called the cell body, where it has the machinery for making energy. And that small part has to support a long extension that is absolutely gigantic compared to the size of the energy storage depot. And it's got to constantly maintain the nutrition for all of that. So you can imagine the slightest insult to the energy-producing machinery compromises the neuron much more than any other cell in the body.
And it reminds me of one of the things that I think I've gotten right over the last decade or so is the understanding that we can make new nerve cells.
We used to think, in part because of Ramon y Cajal, even giants occasionally miss certain things. We thought that you're born with all the cells, they can die, but you don't get new ones. Mm-hmm. And now we know there are certain regions of the brain that have stem cell potential, and they continue to divide. In the olfactory part of the brain and also in a certain part of the hippocampus and memory storage site, there are small residues of new cells being born.
And we can train other parts of the brain to take over.
Well, that's a different point, even perhaps more powerful. The plasticity of the brain, the fact that when one part is damaged, one can enhance the power of others to compensate is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And this is being utilized very, very effectively in the treatment of stroke. When I was a medical student, we were taught not to interfere in the recovery of the stroke in the first few weeks. Now, one actively engages people with a stroke to get them going in rehabilitation very, very early.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Dr. Eric Kandel. What's the headline going to be now, Dr. Kandel? I'm going to put your crystal ball out. 5 years, 2 years, whatever down the road, what big headline are we going to be seeing soon?
Well, I think there are many headlines that need to come. I think we're in a crisis in terms of psychiatric disorders.
Really?
Yes, a serious crisis.
In what way? What do you
mean?
When
I was a resident in 1960, drugs for schizophrenia were first coming along. There's reason to believe that there's been some, but very modest improvement in the treatment of schizophrenia since 1960, half a century. In depression, you saw the New York Times the other day, there are selective serotonin uptake inhibitors. Number one, there's been no improvement in them for almost 30 years. Mm. Number two, they only work in certain specific cases of depression. So major mental illness, which is enormous, debilitating range of illnesses, do not have optimal treatment available for them. Why is that so? Well, we don't know where in the brain these diseases occur. We don't know the anatomical basis of that, number one. Number two, we know that these are disorders that have a major genetic component. We have, by and large, not identified most of the genes important for that. So the biological understanding, which is the key to treatment of major mental illnesses, has been unbelievably slow. Mm. And I foresee terrific effort, increased funding, increased research effort, increased recruitment of scientific personnel into these areas.
Mm-hmm. Is the U.S. going to be the leader in this?
I would hope so. To be honest with you, I think these are international problems. Mm-hmm. And if the problem was solved next year in China, I would not cry. I am very proud of the country, and I hope we continue to contribute in important ways. But I think this is an international effort. Wherever the leads come from, we should all jump on it and take advantage of it.
And there's sufficient funding to get us to that?
No.
Next, no.
Nowhere near.
I'm cynical about asking a scientist about money because they always say, I need more money.
I don't do clinical trials. This is not something that involves me. Stepping back, we clearly see that we don't have the funds necessary to move this. In fact, science in general doesn't get the amount of money that it needs in order to carry forward.
Mm-hmm. And so if there were one place to invest that funding, it would be where? Which would be the place?
Well, I'm not sure I'm positioned to say in all of the health sciences what's the most important area. But certainly we've put a lot of support into public health measures, and they've been remarkable. I mean, the decrease of incidence of heart disease, hypertension has been spectacular. I think most people would agree psychiatric illness is a major need area.
And in your lab, what are we going to see next coming out of here?
Well, I'm interested in how memory is perpetuated, how you remember something for the rest of your life. And Cal 6C, when he was in my lab, and I found a new mechanism for the perpetuation of memory storage, which is a self-perpetuating protein. And we're looking into that in a variety of contexts.
And you have a company that's going to try to increase
We had a
memory?
Company that was involved in developing drugs for age-related memory loss. That's been bought by Hoffman LaRoche. That was called Memory Pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm. And so you think there could be a pill, or that's what they
would
think?
Yes, there are many companies that are working on pills, both for age-related memory loss and for Alzheimer's. And I'm hopeful that there will be progress in that area. There has been a lot of good basic science, particularly in Alzheimer's disease, and we should see progress.
And so you have an opening tonight? You're going to get dressed up in your tux? Or
I'm wearing my bar mitzvah suit right as we talk. For you, I wore one of my better bow ties.
It's a beauty. Well, we wish you mazel tov on your film.
Thank you.
And congratulations. We hope for a great opening success. And come back. Feel free to come back and talk to us anytime you want.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eric Kandel, senior investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, university professor at Columbia University, director of the Kavli Institute for Brain Science, and his film In Search of Memory, following his book, opens today in New York and hopefully headed to a city and a theater near you. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Also, serve over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have our Flora Lichtman has our video pick of the week up there, and it takes us to a quarry up in the Palisades here in New Jersey. And you can watch this great site where we have all this rock that's possibly we could store all the CO2 in the rock. It's terrific view of the quarry. So you'd want to check out our video there and all the other videos. We have dozens of them. Also, we're podcasting and blogging and tweeting. If you tweet, be careful all week long. So have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.